Chapter 26. Westwood copied and pasted the six names and numbers to a new blank screen. The names were a standard American mixture. They could have been the first six up for any team in the majors, or they could have been any six guys in line at the pawn shop, or the ER, or the first-class lounge at the airport. Half the numbers were cell phones, Reacher guessed, because he didn't recognize the area codes. But there was a 773 for Chicago in there, and a 505 for somewhere in New Mexico, and a 901, which he figured could be Memphis, Tennessee. Westwood put his phone in a dock on his desk and dialed the first number direct from his computer. There were speakers in the dock, and Reacher heard the beep-bop-bap of the electronic pulses, and then nothing but hiss, and then a pre-recorded voice, pitched somewhere between scolding and sympathetic. The number was out of service. Westwood hung up and checked the area code on his screen. He said, "That was a cell phone in northern Louisiana. Maybe Shreveport or close by. The contract was probably terminated or canceled, as happens in the normal run of things, and the number will be reissued sooner or later." He dialed the second number. Same thing. The dialing sounds, then nothing, then the phone company voice, its script apologetic, its tone faintly incredulous that anyone would do anything as pitifully dumb as try to call a telephone number that was currently out of service. "A cell in Mississippi," Westwood said. "Somewhere north. Oxford, probably. A lot of college students there. Maybe his parents threw him off the family plan." "Or maybe it was a burner phone," Reacher said. "A pay-as-you-go from a drugstore that ran out of minutes, or was trashed. Maybe they were all burners."
"Possible," Westwood said. "Bad guys have done that for years to stop the government building a case. And these days citizens are learning to do the same thing. Especially the kind of citizens who call newspapers with hot tips about conspiracies. Such is the modern world."
He dialed the third number, another cell according to the list of area codes, this one in Idaho. And this one was answered. A guy's voice came over the speakers, loud and clear. It said,
"Hello?"
Westwood sat up straight and spoke to the screen. He said,
"Good morning, sir. This is Ashley Westwood from the L.A. Times, returning your call."
"It is?"
"I apologize for the delay. I had some checking to do. But now I agree. What you told me has to be exposed. So I need to ask you some questions."
"Well, yes. Sure, that would be great."
The voice was pitched closer to alto than tenor, and it was a little fast and shaky with nerves. A thin guy, Reacher thought, always quivering and vibrating. 35, maybe, or younger, but not much older. Could be Idaho born and bred, but probably wasn't. Westwood said, "First, I need to start with a trust builder. I need you to confirm the name of the private detective you hired." The voice said,
"The name of the what?"
"The private detective."
"I don't understand."
"Did you hire a private detective?"
"Why would I do that?"
"Because it has to be stopped."
"What does?"
"What you told me about."
"A private detective would be no good for that. They'd do the same to him they do to everyone else. As soon as they saw him. I mean, literally, I told you, it's a line of sight thing. No one can avoid it. You don't understand. The beam cannot be beaten."
"So you didn't hire a private detective?"
"No, I didn't."
"Do you use another cell phone with a 501 area code?"
"No, I don't."
Westwood hung up on him without another word. He said,
"I think I remember that guy. Apparently our minds are being controlled by beams."
Reacher said, "What kind of beams?"
"Mind-controlling beams. They come off the bottom of civilian airliners. The FAA requires them. That's why they charge for checked bags now, so people will use carry-on instead, which leaves more space in the hold for the equipment. And the operator? He's down there, too, like an old-fashioned bomb aimer, zapping people. The guy in Idaho won't go out unless it's cloudy. He says obviously the flyover states are especially vulnerable, all part of the elitist conspiracy.
Except the most flown-over state is nowhere near Idaho.
Where is it?
Pennsylvania.
Really? Chang said, yes, really, because there's a lot of regular East Coast traffic, plus all the shuttles between D.C. and New York and Boston. Now, can we move on? Can we dial the next number?
Westwood dialed the next number, which was the fourth, which was 901 for Memphis. The first landline, probably. They heard the dialing noises, and then the ringtone, loud in the room. The call was answered. There was a hollow clunk as a heavy handset was lifted, and a male voice said, yes? Westwood sat up straight again and ran through the same bullshit as before. His name, the L.A. Times, the returned call, the apology for the delay. The voice said, sir, I'm not sure I understand. The guy was old, Reacher figured, slow-spoken and courtly, and if he wasn't from Memphis, he was from somewhere very close by. Westwood said, you called me at the L.A. Times 2 or 3 months ago with something on your mind? The old guy said, sir, if I did, I surely have no recollection of it. And if I offended you in any way at all, why then, certainly I apologize.
No, you didn't offend me, sir. No apology required. I want to know more about your concerns, that's all.
Oh, I have very few concerns. My situation is blessed.
Then why did you call me?
I really can't answer that question. I'm not even certain I did.
Westwood glanced at Chang and back to the screen and took a breath, ready to speak again, but there was a muffled sound on the speaker and another clunk, apparently, as the handset was wrestled away, because at that point a woman's voice came on the line and said,
who is this, please?
Westwood said, Ashley Westwood, ma'am, at the L.A. Times, returning a call from this number.
A recent call?
2 or 3 months ago.
That will have been my husband.
May I speak with him?
You just were.
I see. He didn't remember the call.
He wouldn't. 2 or 3 months is a very long time.
Would you have any idea what the call might have been about?
Don't you?
Westwood didn't answer. The woman said,
I'm not judging you. If I could tune him out, I would. Are you a political writer or a science writer?
Westwood said, science.
Then it will have been about granite countertops being radioactive. That's this year's topic, which they are, as a matter of fact, but it's a question of degree. I'm sure he asked you to write a story about it, you and many others.
Do you know how many others?
A small number compared to the population of the United States, but a large number compared to how many hours an old man should spend on the telephone.
Westwood said, ma'am, is it possible he hired a private detective? The woman said,
for what?
To help him with his investigations into the granite situation?
No, it would be most unlikely.
Can you be certain?
The facts are not in dispute. There's nothing to investigate, and he has no access to money. He couldn't hire anybody.
Not even cash?
Not even. Don't ask, and don't get old.
Does your husband have a cell phone?
No.
Could he have gotten one, maybe, from a drugstore?
No, he never leaves the house.
Have people died because of the granite?
He says so.
How many, exactly?
Oh, thousands.
Okay, Westwood said. Thank you. I'm sorry for disturbing you.
My pleasure, the woman said. Makes a change, talking to someone else.
They heard a slow pause and a final clonk as the big old handset was put back in its cradle. Westwood said,
Welcome to my life.
Chang said,
It's better than hers.
Westwood dialed the fifth number, area code 773, which was Chicago. It rang and rang way past the point where an answering machine would have cut it short. Then, suddenly, an out-of-breath woman came on the line and said,
City Library, Lincoln Park, volunteer room.
She sounded very young and very cheerful and very busy. Westwood introduced himself and asked who he was talking to. The kid gave a name, no hesitation at all, but said she had never called the L.A. Times and knew no private detectives. Westwood asked her if the phone they were on was used by other people, and she said yes, by all the volunteers. She said she was one of them. She said the volunteer room was where they left their coats and took their breaks. There was a phone in there, and time to use it, occasionally. She said the Lincoln Park Library was a little ways north of downtown Chicago, and it had dozens of volunteers, always changing, young and old men and women, all of them fascinating. But no, none of them seemed to be obsessed about anything scientific. Not overtly. Certainly not to the extent of calling distant newspapers. Westwood checked his list for the name against the 773 number, as recorded contemporaneously in the company database. He said,
Do you know a volunteer called McCann?
I'm not entirely sure if it would be Mr. or Ms.
No,
the kid said.
I never heard that name.
Westwood asked, How long have you volunteered there?
A week,
the kid said. And Westwood thanked her, and she said he was welcome. And he said he guessed he should let her go. And she said, Well, yes, she had things to do. And Westwood hung up. He dialed the last number, area code 505, which was New Mexico. Chapter 27. The New Mexico number rang four times and was answered by a man with a quiet, defeated voice. Westwood gave his name and ran through his standard preamble, the L.A. Times, the returned call, the apology for the delay, the sudden revival of interest in the issue. There was a long pause, and the quiet man on the other end of the line said, That was then. It would be a different story now. Westwood said, How so? I know what I saw. At first, no one would listen, including you, I'm afraid. But then the police department sent a detective, a young man, casually dressed, but keen. He said he was from a special confidential unit, and he took my report. He said I should sit tight and do nothing more. But then a week later, I saw him in uniform. On traffic duty. He was writing parking tickets. He wasn't a detective at all. The police department had fobbed me off with a rookie. To keep me quiet, I suppose. They had me off. Westwood said, Tell me again exactly what you saw. A spacecraft in the desert just landed, with six passengers disembarking. They resembled humans, but weren't, and the important thing was the craft looked to have no means of taking off again. It was a landing module only, which meant those creatures were set to stay, which begged a question. Were they the first? If not, how many came before them? How many are already here? Do they already control the police department? Do they already control everything. Westwood said nothing. The quiet man said,
So now the story would be psychological rather than purely scientific. How does an individual cope when he knows something but is forced to pretend he doesn't? Westwood asked,
Did you hire a private detective?
I tried to. The first three I called wouldn't take on extraterrestrial investigations. Then I realized it would be safer to lie low. That's the issue now, the stress. I suppose many of us are in the same boat. We know, but we feel like the only one because we can't talk to each other. Maybe that's what you should write about. The isolation. What happened to the spaceship? I couldn't find it again. I imagine their allies hauled it away and hid it. Has anyone died as a result? I don't know. Possibly. How many? One or two, conceivably. I mean, a controlled landing implies considerable energy. Flames from retro rockets and so on. It might have been dangerous inside a certain perimeter, and no one knows what they do later after they settle in. Do you have a cell phone?
No.
The radiation is too dangerous. It can cause brain cancer. Does the name Kiever mean anything to you? Is he one of the folks you called?
No,
I never heard that name. Thank you, Westwood said. I'll be back in touch. He hung up. Chang said,
I know. Welcome to your life.
Westwood said,
Welcome to New Mexico.
He deleted the third, the fourth, and the sixth numbers from his temporary list. He said, Beam Boy and Granite Guy and Close Encounters Guy aren't it. Agreed? Which leaves us the abandoned cell phone in Louisiana and the abandoned cell phone in Mississippi and the volunteer room in Chicago. We cut the odds in half, at least. He neatened up the new three-line layout on his screen. At the top was the Louisiana number, which 10 weeks ago had belonged to a person named Headley, according to the database, and below it was the Mississippi number with the name Ramirez, and below that was the Chicago rec room, one user of which had been the elusive Mr. McCann, according to the database, or Ms. McCann, neither of which the out-of-breath kid had ever heard of. Westwood printed the page and handed it to Chang. She said,
Try the Maloney number again.
Westwood dialed it. Beep, boop, bap, and it rang and rang, and it wasn't answered, and voicemail didn't cut in. He hung up after another whole minute of trying. Reacher said, We need a list of everything you published in the last 6 months. Westwood said,
Why?
Because why else would the guy call you? He saw something you wrote. We need to know what it was.
That won't help us find him.
I agree, it won't. But we need to know what kind of guy we're dealing with when we get there. We need to know what his problem is.
All my stuff is on the website. You can check it, going back years.
Okay, Reacher said. Many thanks for your help.
What now?
We'll figure something out. Like you said, we cut the odds in half. We have three to choose from. We'll track them down.
Here's another theory, Westwood said. I checked Kiever's webpage, obviously, and Ms. Chang's, too. It all looks very competent. I'm sure you have all kinds of resources available to you, including your own private databases and reverse phone directories, and possibly your own sources inside the phone companies themselves. Therefore, my new theory is you don't need me anymore. My theory is you'll cut me out completely now.
We won't, Chang said. We'll keep you in the loop.
Why would you?
We don't want the book rights.
Why wouldn't you?
I'm too busy, and he can barely write his own name with a crayon.
Reacher said nothing. Westwood said,
So I stay in.
Chang said,
All for one and one for all.
Promise?
Cross my heart.
But only if it's a good story. Please, don't bring me beams or granite or spaceships.
Reacher and Chang left Westwood in his office and rode the elevator back to the street. Chang had a laptop computer in her suitcase, and all she needed was a quiet space and a Wi-Fi connection, and then she could get to work with her private databases and her reverse phone directories and her list of sources inside the phone companies themselves, which meant a hotel, which meant finding a taxi. There was one parked at the curb across the street, and Reacher whistled and waved at it, but for some reason it took off fast in the other direction without them. Every city had its own hailing protocol, and it was hard to keep track. They walked north toward the Children's Museum and found cabs lined up and ready to go. The kind of places Reacher knew in L.A. weren't notably quiet and might not have had Wi-Fi, so he let Chang decide their destination. She told the driver West Hollywood, and the guy set out through the traffic. 10 minutes later, 20 miles south of Mother's Rest, the man with the ironed jeans and the blow-dried hair took a third call on his landline. This time, his contact was in a chatty mood. The guy said,
It was a gift. They met in the L.A. Times office for nearly an hour, which is an old building with thick walls. But Hackett got lucky. Apparently, most of the business was done on the phone, and apparently Westwood uses his phone in a dock on his desk, and his desk is under his window. So Hackett had an amplified signal blasting straight through the glass. His scanner nearly blew up. They made 7 calls in total. 2 were expired cell phones, 1 was a cell phone that didn't answer, and 1 was a public phone in Chicago. The other 3 were weirdos they gave up on. Kiever's name was mentioned once, and private detectives in general all 3 times, plus once more to the shared number in Chicago, where Westwood also asked about the name McCann.
The man south of Mother's Rest was quiet for a very long time. Then he said,
But no real progress?
That's for you to decide. They got 3 possibles. I'm sure one of them was Kiever's client, and I'm sure you know which. They got phone data which can be checked. I've seen things go bad from less.
I need to know if they contact the phone companies, like a distant early warning system. And if they do, I need to know what the phone companies tell them.
That would cost extra, I'm afraid. Phone companies can be secretive. Palms would need to be greased.
Do it.
Okay.
Then what happened?
Then it got a little comical.
How so?
Westwood stayed inside and Reacher and Chang left.
Where did they go?
That's where it got comical. Hackett lost them. He was posing as a cab driver. No better cover in a city. But Reacher tried to hail him, so he had to take off fast.
That's not good.
He has Chang's phone in his system. As soon as she makes a call, he'll know exactly where they are.
Chapter 28. The address in West Hollywood that Chang chose was a motel, not unlike the one in Mother's Rest, except its more glamorous location made it hip and ironic, rather than old and sad. Reacher paid cash for a room which had a desk and a chair and a choice of wired or wireless connection. But best of all, It had a king-size bed, flat and wide and firm. They both looked at it and kissed, meaning it, but only briefly, like people who knew they had work to do first. Chang sat down and plugged in her laptop. She unfolded the paper Westwood had printed. "Three names, three numbers," she said.
"Are you a gambling man?"
Reacher said, "Louisiana is right next to Arkansas, which could explain why the guy has those two area codes. But so is Mississippi, just the same. Chicago isn't, but a guy with the real name McCann might choose Maloney for an alias. Maybe it was his mother's name. So at this point, I would say it's even money."
"Where do you want to start?"
"With the current 501. It might be a recent contract. It might have a real name on it."
"If it isn't a burner."
She opened a search page, just as ugly as Westwood's, and typed in the number 501 and seven more digits. The screen said, "Refer." Reacher said, "What does that mean?" She said,
"It means it isn't in the reverse directory, but there's information to be had. At a price. From a source in the phone company."
"How big of a price?"
$100, probably."
"Can you afford it?"
"If it comes to anything, I'll bill the L.A. Times."
"Check the others first, in case you need a quantity discount." Which turned out to be a possibility. The Chicago number came back exactly as advertised, one of a dozen lines into the Lincoln Park branch of the city library. But both the Louisiana cell and the Mississippi cell came back as "refer." "Information to be had." Reacher said, "How exactly do we get it?" Chang said,
"We used to email, but not now. Too vulnerable. Too risky for the source. Worse than a paper trail. Now we have to call."
She picked up her phone and dialed. The call was answered fast. There was no small talk. Chang was all business. She gave her name and explained what she needed and read out the three numbers slowly and distinctly and listened to them repeated back and said okay and hung up.
$200, she said. "He'll get back to me later today."
Reacher said, "How much later?"
"Could be hours."
There was only one thing to do, to fill the time. 10 minutes later, 20 miles south of Mother's Rest, the man with the ironed jeans and the blow-dried hair took a fourth call on his landline. His contact said,
"Hackett says Chang just made a call. He says they're in a motel in West Hollywood."
"Who did she call?"
"The phone company. She wanted information on three numbers. She paid $200 for it."
"What information did she get?"
"None yet. Her source said he'd call back later today."
"How much later?"
"Could be hours."
"Can you get it faster?"
"Save your money. Hackett is listening. You'll know when she knows."
"How far away is he?"
"He's heading to West Hollywood now. I'm sure he'll be in place before the guy calls back."
The motel bed was indeed flat and wide and firm. Reacher lay on his back, filmed with sweat. The AC not really cold, the ceiling fan busted. Chang lay beside him, breathing deep. Reacher's theory had always been the second time was by far the best. No more tiny inhibitions, and no more first-time fumbles, yet still plenty of novelty and excitement. But that theory had been shattered. It had been blown apart. All theories should be tested, Westwood had said. That's a central part of the scientific method. And tested it they had. The second time, an hour ago, had been sensational. But the third time had been better. Way better. Reacher lay there, drained, empty, his bones turned to rubber, relaxed in a way that made any previous notion of repose seem like furious agitation. Eventually, Chang rolled up on one elbow and traced her fingers over his chest, to his neck, to his face, and down again, as if learning him, as if memorizing the slabs and contours of his body. In turn, he was happy with stillness, his hand on the inside of her thigh, unmoving but alive with the thrill of hot skin, damp but velvet smooth, the muscle under it slack, a tiny pulse ticking against his palm. She said,
"Reacher."
He said, "Yes?"
"Nothing. I'm just trying it out."
Her hair was on his shoulder, thick and heavy. Her breasts were crushed against his arm. He could feel the beat of her heart. She said,
"Have you ever been married?"
"No," he said. "You?"
"Once, but it didn't last."
"Like so many." She said,
"What's the longest relationship you ever had?"
6 months, he said, or thereabouts. Postings made it difficult. I got moved too often. It was a lottery, a double lottery if she was in the service, too. Mostly it was like ships that pass in the night. Her phone rang. She pushed off him and twisted upright and padded naked across the room to the desk. She checked the incoming number and answered the call. No small talk, all business. The phone company, presumably. She found a pen and padded back to the nightstand where there was a pad of motel paper, all brittle and yellowed with age. She carried it back to the desk and bent down and started making notes. First on one page, and then on a second, and then on a third. At one point she turned toward him and leaned forward and winked. He propped himself on his elbows. She said,
"Thank you,"
and clicked off her call. He said,
"What?"
She said,
"Wait."
She woke her computer and clicked and typed, and her face was lit by cold gray light from the screen. She put her fingertips on the touchpad and swiped and scrolled and zoomed. Then she smiled. He said,
"What?"
She said,
"All three numbers were burner phones, all prepaid, all bought at pharmacies. The Louisiana phone is recent, from a drugstore in Shreveport. It had to be registered before it could be used. That's the system now. You buy it. You use it to call an 800 number, it gets assigned an area code local to where you're calling from, plus an available number," which all happened. Then it was used 11 times, and then it ran out of minutes, and it wasn't topped up fast enough, so it lapsed. It was taken off the air. The number will be reissued about 6 months from now.
Who did it call?
Westwood, in L.A. All 11 times.
From where?
Shreveport. The same cell tower every time.
Reacher said nothing. Chang said,
"And the Mississippi phone was exactly the same, more or less, except it's a little older. It was bought a year ago at a drugstore in Oxford and registered with a local Mississippi area code and topped up 4 times, but eventually abandoned. All usage was in Oxford, all on 2 towers. Dozens of calls to Westwood, from a school and a dorm, maybe, if he was right, and the guy was a college student."
"Good to know," Reacher said, "but not worth a wink and a smile. So, tell me about the Arkansas number. I'm guessing that's where the action is."
Chang smiled again, still naked, still happy, relieved, satisfied, and excited. She said,
"The Arkansas number is different.
It's a drugstore burner, like the others, except it's still on the air, even though it's originally much, much older. It was part of a huge Walmart order from years ago. Back then, they came with numbers already built in and pre-assigned, hence the Arkansas area code, because Walmart's HQ is in Arkansas. But it wasn't sold there. Wasn't sold anywhere, in fact, at least not by Walmart. It got replaced by a newer model, and earlier this year, the last of the unsold stock was auctioned off for 10 cents on the dollar. About 100 units, my guy thinks.
Who bought them?
A middleman in New Jersey, a kind of broker, a specialist in such things.
And he sold them on?
That's what middlemen do.
When?
12 weeks ago.
Who did he sell them to?
Chang's smile got wider. She said,
he sold them to a mom-and-pop drugstore in Chicago.
He said, where in Chicago?
She turned her laptop so he could see its screen. He craned his neck. Gray light and straight lines.
Google Maps, he figured, or Google Earth, or whatever kind of Google it was that showed satellite pictures of city streets.
Chang said,
it's a little ways north of downtown. It's literally right next door to the Lincoln Park branch of the city library.
Still naked, still excited, still smiling, Chang tried the number again, the grandfathered 501 area code, plus 7 more digits. But as before, it rang and rang without being answered and without going to voicemail. She gave it a whole hopeful minute, and then she hung up. Then she put her phone on speaker and called Westwood and found him in his office at the L.A. Times. She said,
the 501 number is a pharmacy burner that was sold in a store right next to the Lincoln Park Library in Chicago. Therefore, Maloney is McCann. We're assuming he volunteers in the library, which would give him open access to the 773 number he used before. Then, when you blocked him, he went next door and bought a cell phone and tried again. We need to know his history. We need to know when he started calling.
Westwood said,
I'll check.
They heard pattering keys and clicking and scrolling and breathing. Reacher pictured the twin screens and the phone in the dock. Then Westwood came back and said,
the first McCann call came in a little over 4 months ago. There were 15 more before I blocked him. Then he changed to Maloney and called 3 more times. But you know that.
Got notes on the earlier calls?
Nothing, I'm sorry.
Don't worry, we'll figure it out.
Keep in touch.
We will.
She hung up.
Reacher said, we should find the main number for the library. They must have details on their volunteers. We could get a home address.
She said, we should shower first and get dressed. I feel weird doing this with no clothes on.
Reacher said nothing. The man with the ironed jeans and the blow-dried hair took a 5th call on his landline. His contact said,
the phone company just called her back. Then she called the L.A. Times immediately. She's all excited about a guy named McCann in Chicago.
There was a long, long pause. Then the man with the jeans and the hair asked,
did she speak to him?
To McCann? His contact said, no.
But she has his phone number.
Actually, she has 2 phone numbers, although one of them seems to be in a public library. Apparently, McCann volunteers there.
She already knows where he works?
Volunteering is not the same thing as working.
Why hasn't she spoken to him?
She tried to. She called his cell, but he didn't answer.
Why wouldn't he?
How would I know?
I'm asking you as a professional. I want analysis. That's what I pay you for. What are the possible reasons for not answering a cell phone call?
Sudden decease of the cell phone owner? Loss of the cell phone under the seat of a city bus or similar? Not recognizing the incoming caller ID while in a misanthropic mood? Being in a location or environment where taking a call would be socially unacceptable? There are hundreds of reasons.
What's her next move?
She'll keep trying the cell number, and she'll go through the main switchboard at the library to get whatever data is kept on the volunteers.
Like an address?
That might be difficult. There would be privacy issues.
So what then?
She'll go to Chicago. She'll go anyway. If McCann was Kiever's client, she'll want to interview him. And she can't expect him to fly out to her.
And Reacher will go with her to Chicago.
Most likely.
I can't let them do that.
They're too close already. How do you propose to stop them?
Your boy Hackett is right there.
At the moment, Hackett is engaged for surveillance only.
That might need to change. You told me about the menu.
You need to think about this carefully. Not just the money. It's a big step.
I can't let them get to Chicago.
You need to be very sure. This kind of decision benefits from absolute certainty.
We should have stopped them ourselves when we had the chance.
I'll need a formal instruction.
The man with the jeans and the hair said, "Tell Hackett to stop them now. Permanently." Chapter 29. The shower made for a slow and gentle transition between what they had been doing and what they had to do next. The tub was narrow, but the curtain was on a bowed-out rail, and the spray was wide and warm, and they didn't want to get more than an inch away from each other anyway, so all was comfortable. They washed each other, like a game, top to bottom, slowly, carefully, soap and shampoo, no crevice neglected, and some lingered over. They took their time. There was a certain amount of fooling around. Steam rose and filled the room, and the mirror fogged. Then eventually they climbed out and dried off with thin towels, and they rubbed circles in the steam on the mirror, one high up, one lower down, and they combed their hair, Reacher with his fingers, Chang with a tortoiseshell implement she fetched from his suitcase. They collected their clothes from where they had fallen, on the floor and the chair and the bed, and they dragged them on over still damp skin. Then it was back to business. Reacher reopened the drapes and saw nothing outside except bright sun and blue sky. It was a spectacular day. Southern California, in late summer. Even the band of smog low down looked golden. Chang tried the 501 cell again. As before, it rang endlessly, without an answer. She kept it going. It purred dolefully but relentlessly on the speaker, on and on. Reacher said, "I never had this happen before. Either someone answers, or it goes to an answering machine."
Maybe those old burners didn't have voicemail yet. Or maybe he didn't set it up, or he disabled it.
Can you do that?
I don't know.
Why isn't he answering?
He can't have it both ways. Either you use voicemail or you answer your damn phone.
He's given up. No one would listen to him.
so he dumped the phone. It's ringing in a drawer somewhere.
Reacher was a need-to-know person where technology was concerned. He understood faxes and telexes and military radio and the United States Postal Service, but he had never needed to know anything about civilian cell phones. He had never owned one. Why would he? Who would he call? Who would call him? The little he understood came from everyday observation. He pictured the phone in his mind, ringing and ringing, vibrating too, probably, ringing and buzzing, powerful and energetic. He said, "The battery must be charged. If it went dead, the phone would switch off and the network would know, so we must plug it in from time to time."
So maybe he went out to the store and left it behind.
Reacher glanced out the window and didn't answer. The phone kept on ringing. Chang said,
"What?"
"Nothing." But in his mind's eye, he was getting a lonely picture of a phone on the floor, alive, hopping around, like a faithful spaniel pawing at its dead master, trying to get his attention, not understanding. Out on the moors, maybe, or in a grand living room. A heart attack, perhaps. A gout, or whatever guys with spaniels died of. But he was a need-to-know, data-driven person, so all he said was, "Shut it down and try the library switchboard instead." Chang killed the call, and the room went quiet. She woke her computer and clicked her way to a web page for the Chicago Library System. The Lincoln Park branch had its own inquiries number, a 773 area code, plus seven more digits, not far removed from the volunteer room number they had gotten before. She dialed and got a menu, English or Spanish. Touch one for this, touch two for that. To speak with a person, touch nine. She touched nine. There was a ringtone, and then a woman's voice came on and said,
"How may I help you?"
Chang introduced herself the same way she had to Westwood, the very first time. She said her name and said she was a private detective now based in Seattle, but previously with the FBI, and that last part seemed to help. The woman in Chicago seemed impressed. Chang said,
"I understand you have volunteers helping out."
"That's correct,"
the woman said.
"Do you have a volunteer named McCann?"
"We did."
"But not anymore?"
"We haven't seen him for 3 or 4 weeks."
"Did he quit?"
"Not as such, but volunteers tend to come and go."
"What can you tell me about him?"
"Why do you need to know?" "Is he in trouble?"
"He was my firm's client, but we lost touch. We're trying to reconnect to see if he still needs our help."
"He's an older man, very quiet, keeps himself to himself, but he does good work. We'd like to reconnect, too."
"Did he have any burning interests or things on his mind?"
"I'm not sure. He was never exactly a chatterbox."
"Is he local? Do you have an address for him?"
"Dead air from Chicago." Then the woman said,
"I'm sorry, but I'm really not permitted to give out that kind of information. We have to respect our volunteers' privacy."
"Do you have a phone number for him? At his home? Perhaps you could call him and ask him to call us?"
Silence from Chicago, just tiny plastic clicks. A database, possibly. A long list on a computer. Lots of scrolling required. M for McCann would be exactly halfway. Then the woman came back on the line and said,
"No, I'm afraid we don't have a phone number for him."
After that, they checked Chang's secret private eye databases for guys named McCann in Chicago, in case he stood out some other way. But they got hundreds of random hits, as was to be expected, Reacher supposed, given ethnic names and historic patterns of migration. Maybe the McCann was one of them, but there was no way of knowing. He was hidden like a grain of sand on a beach. After that, they checked the airlines. There was plenty of choice. LAX to ORD was a big deal route. There were multiple departures all through the afternoon hours, which made sense. Folks could get home before their natural bedtimes, 2 time zones east. Anything later approached red-eye territory. The major carriers were all charging the same price to the penny, so Chang went with American, where she had a gold card, and she booked on the phone to a gold card person. More reliable in urgent situations, she said, and better seats. Reacher put his toothbrush in his pocket, and she packed her suitcase with her comb and her computer and its charger and her phone charger. She zipped it up. She said, "Okay." Reacher nodded and said, "Let's go find a cab." Chapter 30. They stepped out the door and blinked in the bright sun and stopped by the office to return the key. The clerk seemed perturbed by their early departure. At first, worried there was something wrong with the room, and when they told him there wasn't, he seemed to assume they saw the place as a hot sheets by the hour convenience and got upset all over again. Reacher told him it was an urgent change of plan, that was all, just business, nothing more. But he saw the guy's point. Their hair was still wet from the shower, and the afterglow was coming off them in waves, like nuclear radiation. There was a cab at the curb across the street. Reacher whistled and waved, the same as before, and this time it worked. The cab pulled a slow curb-to-curb U-turn and came to rest with the rear door handle exactly level with Reacher's hip. The driver popped the trunk and climbed out to help with Chang's suitcase. He was a big guy in a short-sleeved shirt, his forearms roped with muscle, his nose bent from an earlier break, his eyebrows thick with scar tissue. A boxer in his youth, Reacher thought. Or just plain unlucky. The guy lifted the suitcase like it was weightless and placed it in the trunk. Chang slid in across the vinyl bench behind the driver's seat, and Reacher climbed in beside her. The driver got back behind the wheel and caught Reacher's eye in the mirror. LAX, Reacher said. American. Domestic. The cab took off, slow and steady through the winking sunlight, left and right on the side streets to Santa Monica Boulevard, where it headed south and west toward the 405. This time the guy with the jeans and the hair didn't wait for his landline to ring. He wanted to get ahead of the news, so he dialed his contact preemptively. He said, "Is it done?" His contact said, "Don't worry, it will be." "So it isn't done?" "Not yet." But Hackett was right there. "Let us do what we're good at, okay? 2 dead in a West Hollywood motel room would have been a disaster. They go to town over a thing like that. There would have been 10 squad cars there in a thin minute. They'd have put 4 detectives on it. It would have been on the evening news. Hackett can't afford that kind of exposure. Too much risk. He has to be able to work again."
"So when?"
"Trust me, they won't get on the plane." The 405 was busy, as always, but it was moving. 3 lanes, keeping pace, all bright colors and clean paint and wax and chrome and fierce flashing sun and the tawny hills in the background. The ride was soft. Chang had her window all the way down, and the breeze was warm. It was blowing her hair around. Her T-shirt was damp on the shoulders where it had rested. The driver was neat and precise in his movements. No slamming around. He was staying in the right-hand lane, going with the flow. As good a way as any on L.A.'s freeways. They would get there when they got there. Reacher was leaning back in his seat, still deeply content, still rubbery, and Chang looked the same beside him. She said,
"A library volunteer is bound to be local, right? It's a community thing, basically. It's not like we'll have to search the whole of Chicago."
Reacher said, "You should check what Westwood wrote 4 months ago.
We need to know what was on McCann's mind before we meet him. We need to know what triggered his first call."
Chang took out her phone and used her thumbs to ask for the L.A. Times website. The cell network was slower than Wi-Fi, but it got there in the end. She said,
4 months exactly? Or do we assume he researched an earlier piece?"
"Good point," Reacher said. "I guess if McCann is an internet guy, he could have found anything. But listing everything Westwood ever wrote in his life won't help us. Try a 3-month window. 4, 5, and 6 months back." Chang used the site's own search box and typed Westwood. She got a bunch of stuff about the L.A. neighborhood of the same name, so she changed the search to Ashley Westwood in quote marks, which worked much better. First up was a sidebar section on the right with a photo and a bio of the man himself. The photo looked like it had been taken some years earlier, on a good day. Westwood looked a little younger, and his hair and his beard were a little neater and less gray. The bio said he had postgraduate degrees in molecular biology and journalism. On the left was a list of his articles. Each one had a headline and a capsule summary. First up was a teaser for his piece on the history of wheat, which was due to be published on the upcoming Sunday. Below that was the piece on traumatic brain injuries they had already seen in Kiever's Oklahoma City bedroom. Chang swiped at her screen, and the list spooled upward. She stopped it 8 pieces back, which was 4 months. The guy was doing a new article every 2 weeks, approximately, each one fairly long and presumably researched fairly extensively, which, in terms of civilian employment, was easier than being a coal miner or an ER doctor, no doubt, but not actually easy, in Reacher's opinion. He had never written anything longer than an after-action report, which was generally a discipline much shorter in form, and not necessarily researched, or even non-fiction. First up at the 4-month mark was a piece about organic farming, fruits, vegetables, and staple crops. The headline was provocative, and the capsule summary hinted that big agribusinesses were subverting the definition in order to reap the premium prices without doing the hard work. 2 weeks before that, Westwood had written about gerbils, ancient gerbils, to be precise, according to the headline. Apparently, new research proved the bubonic plague in medieval Europe had been carried not by fleas on rats, as long supposed, but by fleas on giant gerbils from Asia. The traffic was slowing up, in the right-hand lane at least. The middle lane and the left lane were passing them by, but the driver didn't move over. Chang scrolled on down the list. Next up, after the gerbils, was a 5-month-old piece about climate change. The headline said the oceans were rising, and the capsule summary said fractal geometry meant an East Coast seawall would need more concrete than humans had mixed in all their history so far. Chang said,
"Everyone writes about climate change. No need for McCann to pick on Westwood in particular, right?"
Reacher said, "Agreed." Next up was something called the Deep Web, which had to do with search engines and the Internet. Apparently, the surface web was easier to navigate. After that came bees. Apparently, they were dying out the world over. Without them, crops would not get fertilized and everyone would starve, which was a lot more than 200 people. Reacher could see about 200 people right then, out the window, because the traffic was slowing even more. They were still in the right-hand lane. The middle lane and the left-hand lane were still a little faster. A black town car came level on Chang's side and kept pace for a second. A gap opened up ahead of it. Its rear window came down, and Reacher caught a partial glimpse of a guy inside, his head turning toward them. For an absurd split second, it looked like the guy wanted to tell them something. But then the inevitable happened. The town car was in the middle lane, but it was going at the right-hand lane's speed, and behind it a small red coupe didn't slow, inattentive, and it kissed the town car's rear bumper. The speed differential was modest, not more than 5 or 10 miles an hour, but even so the town car was punted solidly forward, and the passenger's head was slammed back against the seat cushion and then hurled forward again, all of Newton's laws of motion in play, inertia and action and reaction. Reacher was surprised by the force of it all. Maybe whiplash really was a thing. The town car motored on into the gap ahead, and the red coupe followed, neither one of them slowing, both of them apparently undamaged. Clearly, federal bumpers worked like they should. There was no fuss, no honking horns, no shaking fists, no middle fingers. All in a day's work, Reacher supposed, in Los Angeles traffic. The right-hand lane slowed even more. Within seconds, the town car and the red coupe were way ahead and out of sight. The left-hand lane was moving even better. Reacher leaned forward and asked, "Why aren't you moving over?" The driver glanced in the mirror and said, "It's all going to jam up soon." "So why not get ahead before it does?"
"It's a hare and tortoise thing, my friend."
Chang put her hand on Reacher's arm and pulled him back. She said,
"Let him do what he's good at. You failed driving, remember?"
She turned back to her phone. The last item in their chosen 3-month window was a piece about an ocean corridor parallel to the West Coast from California to Oregon, which great white sharks used for seasonal migration. Not an issue for most folks, except a Frenchman was proposing to swim through it on his way across the Pacific from Japan. He would sleep on a chase boat every night and start over every morning, 8 hours a day. Apparently, these sharks were a secondary problem. First, he would have to traverse the Pacific Gyre, which was a slow 1,000-mile whirlpool full of dumped plastic and toxic sludge and all kinds of other crap. Chang said,
"The French are crazy."
Reacher said, "My mother was French."
"Was she crazy?"
"Pretty much." The traffic slowed again, proportionately, the left-hand lane to what the middle lane had been doing, and the middle lane to what the right-hand lane had been doing, and the right-hand lane itself almost to a stop. Still, the driver wouldn't move over. He just inched along, stopping and starting, barely faster than walking. Then they found out why. Just past Culver City and just before Inglewood, with LAX not far away, the guy pulled off the freeway into a sudden, unmarked exit on the right, which led to a narrow road that looked like the entrance to some kind of an abandoned maintenance depot. The cab crunched over debris-strewn blacktop, all alone between rusty iron sheds, and then it turned and bumped across broken concrete into a dead-end fork, with nothing up ahead but a derelict warehouse which had a busted door hanging open. The guy drove straight inside, into the dark.